This is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests. In this case, Kevin Cooper, who has been on death row in San Quentin in California. He's been there for 33 years for a very gruesome crime, everybody agrees, in which two adults and two children were killed back in 1983, and he was convicted 2 years later. Let me just say by preface, my wife, Narda Zucchino, who was the associate editor of the LA Times, an experienced journalist, has spent the last 2 years investigating this case and is convinced that Kevin Cooper is innocent of the crime that he was convicted for, and that this is a really a grievous miscarriage of justice. And having read all the documents that are around, I am in agreement with that judgment. But more important, a judge in the Ninth Circuit Court, Judge Fletcher, filed an opinion that was endorsed in the demand for a new trial by 11 judges on the California Ninth Circuit, the Federal Ninth Circuit in California. I want to just quote what he said at the time. He opened his dissenting opinion saying the state of California may be about to execute an innocent man. And 4 years later, in a speech at Yale University, Judge William C. Fletcher of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, "The murders were horrible, and Kevin Cooper is on death row because the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department framed him. And the first reports out after that murder were that three white men were what they were looking for, and they ended up with one black man who had been on a minimum security prison farm, had walked off and had dreadlocks, was unmistakably a black man, and yet he was the one that was singled out." And as Judge Fletcher points out, there's a great deal of evidence pointing to the people who actually did it, and it wasn't Kevin Cooper. Welcome, Kevin. Now, where are you now? Are you in that?
I'm currently right now in a cage that I'm forced to live in against my will. That I've a cage like this I've been in for over 33 years here at San Quentin Prison.
I think at the time you told me it was 11 foot by 4.5 feet, something like that.
Yes, 4.5 feet wide, 11 feet long.
Yeah, I just want to get that across because we're talking about, I mean, I can't even imagine being in there a day or in a night or something. And the idea that you've been for 33 years in a case where clearly, whatever, you know, you think about the death penalty, whatever you think about the justice system in the United States and in California, the amount of what are called Brady violations, non-disclosure of evidence that would support Kevin Cooper's case, tampering with evidence. Judge Fletcher, in his dissenting opinion, goes through a great deal of that evidence. There are some terrific lawyers who have been working pro bono on this case. And I would say the evidence is overwhelming that you've been framed. Let's cut to the chase of it, as Judge Fletcher does, and he makes it very clear. And can you tell me, though, what happened now? You've been fighting this case, and then the voters of California did something in the name of efficiency that is actually terrifying in its implication. Instead of ending the death penalty, as just about every civilized country in the world has done, they hasten it. And now you are slated to be one of the first individuals executed under this new law passed by the voters of California. Are you not?
Yes, I am. Prop 66 did pass, mainly because in 2004, when this state and its death penalty supporting people attempted to murder me by lethal injection, I got a stay of execution, and that was because of another dissent by another Ninth Circuit judge named James R. Browning. But I came within 3 hours and 42 minutes of being strapped down to that gurney and injected with lethal poison and tortured, murdered by these people. But they didn't do it then, so I got away, so now they want to do it again. And this time they plan on finishing the job.
By the way, full disclosure, I'm also your editor at Truthdig, and you've written about some of this in a very compelling way. But take us back to that moment when the state of California was going to end your life.
I was in a death chamber waiting room. They stripped me down butt naked like a slave on an auction block, and they examined my body the same way they examine slaves on auction blocks, from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet and every part in between. And my life was on the clock. Every minute that ticked by, I knew I was going to be murdered by these people. You know, it's just an unreal, surreal type experience, but it is real. You know that these people are not playing with you. They are going to murder you. It's hard to put into words. I mean, for anybody to really understand, it's one of those real-life events that you have to experience personally to really understand. But this is wrong, because I was psychologically tortured beforehand, and afterwards I've had years of post-traumatic stress disorder from having survived that near-death experience at the hands of these volunteer executioners who are paid by the taxpayers of California. And what I wanted to say earlier before I jumped on this was, this is America, and the death penalty is a part of America. It's a tradition in America. This crime against humanity is nothing new. So when the people of the state of California voted to speed up this thing, they were doing what comes natural to them, to these penalty states and these people who believe and support this thing. So this is all part of the same system that started with the genocide of the indigenous peoples of this land, went on to the slaves that were imported into this land, and then it just went on into the prison system. But it's the same thing. It's the same system. And I'm about to face this stuff again if I don't get some type of relief from the court or from the governor or from somebody.
What I want to really get across is, you know, people can read and see that if there's someone who really requires an innocence hearing, requires a retrial, requires looking at the evidence, that the Brady violations, the tampering, the thing you were told, that's clear. But I also want them to understand there's a human being who's in the midst of this. What are we talking about here? We're talking about killing an innocent person who deserves certainly a hearing, at least. And I found our governor, Jerry Brown, to be kind of oblivious to this. Why? Because he said, I'd have to believe a number of law enforcement agents framed a man. Well, that's what Judge Fletcher said. He said, you are on death row because the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department framed him.
Let me say this, if you don't mind. You said something earlier about, I deserve to have this stuff looked at. But that's the problem. Nobody wants to look at it. Jerry Brown, when he was the Attorney General, made a statement that there are no innocent people on death row. And other people have supported him. Republican district attorneys like that lame duck in San Bernardino County, Ramos, and other people have supported that. They have used his words against him. Not too long ago, a death row inmate got off death row because the California Supreme Court said that he was convicted with false evidence, and he was on death row for 24 years. Now, here comes my case, which Governor Brown had in his office for 2.5 years and refused to look at. So my point is this. They don't want to look at it. They don't want to see the truth, because if they see the truth, then they'll see that their system is doing here in California what they've been doing all over the country. Have the innocent people on death row and probably execute them.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
They don't want to know. So if you don't want to know something, you don't look at it. You turn a blind eye to the truth. And this has been the plight of black people in this country. They have long turned a blind eye to the truth concerning us and our plight in this rotten-ass criminal justice system. With us as they may. That's what they go by. They don't give a damn about us. And Jerry Brown, in my opinion, is a moral coward.
Okay, people are going to say Kevin Cooper is saying that in his defense, but I want to remind him, Judge Fletcher, and I am going to post this entire dissent by Judge Fletcher. He said the state failed to provide Cooper a fair hearing, that the state obstructed and impeded Cooper and his lawyers in almost every way imaginable in denying his plea for a new hearing.
And Judge Fletcher was just one of we believe, 14 judges on the Ninth Circuit, even though it was 11 that actually dissented on paper. But of those 11, they all wrote dissents. And one of the judges who wrote a dissent named Kim Wardlaw stated that 24 years of flawed proceedings in my case was like not having no proceedings at all. In other words, I had no due process. None. I was rubber stamped through the system. So, I mean, every one of those 11 judges that dissented, each wrote their piece. And all I'm asking for is what they said they would give me when they put it on paper all those centuries ago. Due process. A trial free of governmental interference. That's what they said on paper all those centuries ago that we could have in the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence or one of them pieces of paper that they wrote it on in the Constitution. Where is mine? All these politicians talking about the Constitution and they stand for the Constitution. Well, damn it, stand for it and stop crushing me and trying to murder me without giving me what I got a right to have that's written in the Constitution. But then again, like you said, I'm just fighting for my life. I'm just a poor black man speaking out of frustration.
I urge people to read the documentation. We're not just, you know, it's not just Kevin Cooper saying this. He's got great lawyers now on a pro bono basis. He's got a guy who was deputy head of the FBI in Los Angeles, who's worked on this case for 8 years. Tell me about your lawyer, though. He's been right with you for a long time.
Norman has been with me for a long time.
Norm.
Pro bono. And he's a good man. And he could have been retired from work a long time ago. But he said no, he wasn't going to retire until he got me out. He's committed to getting me out. And I'm very thankful for that. And I have a lot of respect for him, a lot of appreciation for what this man is doing.
I should point out, no one less than the Pope has spoken out for a new hearing for you and on your behalf. 12 appellate judges, half the jurors who convicted you, and, you know, international human rights organizations, law school deans, innocence projects, and everyone. So you got a lot of support. But at the end of the day, most people, it's out of sight, out of mind. And what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do with this interview, is put you in sight. I have a connection with you as an editor, and I know you're a great writer and how clear you are. You should talk about the books that have influenced you. You're also a very strong, a very compelling painter. So you found avenues for expressing yourself. The announcement said we only have 60 seconds, and that was about 20 seconds ago. I don't know if that means I'm going to lose you now, Kevin, but I'll try to get back to you.
Let me hang up and call back. I got about 6 minutes.
We're back with Kevin Cooper. We're trying to resume our interview from San Quentin by phone. Well, let's just pick up. I quote all these people attesting to your innocence, others demanding that you have a hearing and so forth, but it hasn't happened. Kamala Harris, who's now the senator from California, she was the attorney general, and now she said that, you know, she's all for your having an innocence hearing and a DNA testing. The other senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, says the same thing, and yet it's not happened. How does it register on you that these people, you know, are actually seeming to come out for some measure of justice here, and then yet you sit there trapped in your cell in these extreme dehumanizing situation?
First, I'd like to correct you about something, because this is not my cell. This is more your cell than it is mine, because you're a taxpayer. And the people in the state of California own this cell, not me. I am forced to live here against my will. Concerning Senator Harris and Feinstein and everybody else who is now supposedly on my side or endorsing what we want or seeking as far as DNA testing and innocence hearing, I find it hypocritical that when she was the attorney general of the state, she wouldn't give me no DNA testing or no hearing, or she wouldn't give me a time of day. But now all of a sudden she wants this governor to do something that she wouldn't do. Dianne Feinstein, I believe that she just flipped her script and became a progressive Democrat because of Bernie Sanders and all those other progressive Democrats that are now in Washington, D.C., because before she was for the death penalty. And now she comes out against it. And I like to believe that in time people evolve and can change their positions like that. But her position changed because of other people, not because she had some type of enlightenment about the death penalty. So, you know, I'm not these Democrat hypocrites myself. I mean, it may come back to haunt me to say these things, but I must be truth. If they were in action what they claim to be in words, I've already had an innocence hearing. I would already had an innocence investigation. I already had the DNA testing that we see.
You know, how do you get through the day? That's what I'm trying to figure out here. You know, I've been in there in that one of those cages with you for 5 hours talking about this case, and you're remarkably clear about what's going on and what the evidence is and the injustice it is. How do you get through it?
I choose to fight on because my human spirit will not allow me to quit. I mean, it's just something about me as an individual, and I don't mean that a special or nothing. I mean, I have the same will within me to survive that slaves had on the plantation to survive, or Jewish people had during the Holocaust to survive, or Native Americans had during the Trail of Tears to survive. I mean, there's just something in some of us who won't let us stop. We must continue on. We must fight back. And so that's what I do. I mean, I live in this 4.5 foot wide by 11 foot cage. You know, I do a lot of reading and a lot of writing. I keep my mind occupied. I do my artwork. So I exercise and my body, and I just keep going. I keep pushing forward. I have no choice but to stop because if I do stop, that means they're going to kill me. And I'm not going to let that happen if I can't help it.
Well, tell us about your routine, though. I mean, we're going to be broadcasting is pretty close to Christmas. The Pope has called for your having innocence hearing and he's certainly against the death penalty. Just tell us what this reality, most of us can't even imagine 33 days in a place like San Quentin's death row. Tell us what 33 years have been about.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Okay, so monitor. I'm asking this prisoner on the birth of Christ, I'm asking about his life, so don't cut off the phone call. People have a right to know. What does it mean to be unjustly held on death row for 33 years? Just take us through day after day. What is it?
It's not just that easy. I mean, in order to understand what I'm going through, you have to go through it yourself on a personal experience basis. People have bathrooms in their homes that are larger than this cage that I'm in right now. And everything I do within this cage. I'm talking to you right now on the telephone that is brought to me, and they open the tray slot, you know, where they pass the food in on a tray, and I have to reach out and push the buttons on the phone to talk to you. But I'm in this cage right now. Everything I do, from doing a painting or writing a letter or anything else, I do from within this cage. So I had to turn this cage into something other than a cage. I had to turn it into a classroom. I had to turn it into a church. When I want to go to church, I turn this cage into a church. I turn this cage into what I want it to be.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
For whatever I need it to be to survive. Now, this is abnormal. There is nothing about living in this place and doing what I'm doing that is normal. This is what makes it so hard for me to describe to you what it's like to live in here. Because it is the complete opposite of your world and your life. It's the complete opposite. I can't go nowhere.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
Let me hang up and call back. But this is how I have to live. You know, I'm lucky enough to have a TV, and I can watch a lot of different channels. And because I can watch a lot of different channels, I'm able to hear people speak in their own native tongues about their own experiences in the countries that they're from, because I can get TV stations from around the world. Not because I have cable, because I don't. You know, it's digital TV. It's free over-the-air TV. So I watch a lot of different stations like that. It helps educate me on the plight of poor people. And a lot of poor people, no matter where they are, they're still fighting for the same thing that I'm fighting for from within this prison. Their lives, their freedom, their form of justice. And we all, no matter what language we speak, what tongue we speak, what religion we are, or not, we're all speaking the same language. We're telling the oppressor to get his foot out of our ass, to get his handcuffs off our wrists, to get his needles or his bullets out of our backs and our arms, to get his hands out of our pockets, to leave us alone, to let us be who we are.
Well, I want to go into that. I mean, people listening to this, you know, people can be cynical, they can be whatever they want, but I want to remind them, we're talking about somebody who came a few hours from his death on death row. We're not talking about an abstraction. We're talking about somebody who's going to be the first or second person killed in California, now that the voters went for speeding up the killing. So in this case, the second part of my interview with death row inmate Kevin Cooper. I did part one last week. Kevin is very restricted as far as the ability to talk to people on the outside. I was in there for 5 hours, but couldn't really use the tape recorder. We're doing this by phone. Please bear with us. There are interruptions, but what Kevin has to say is a powerful statement of a man who I think is very much deserving of an innocence hearing and DNA testing. Kevin Cooper, welcome. Well, you know, I mean, just to recap for people, I mean, we're talking about a measure of justice in a case where the evidence has been, this is now the words of appellate court Judge William C. Fletcher, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and he was speaking for almost half of the appellate court that was saying you should have these kind of hearings and so forth. He said, the murders were horrible, we understand that, and Kevin Cooper is on death row because the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department framed him. This is not some wild claim of a supporter of yours. This is a guy who looked through all the evidence, sifted through a trained judge. I just want to be clear here so people understand. This is a matter of evidence, the distortion of evidence, and the fact that we have scientific competence in reinvestigating these things. Because, for instance, the sweat under someone's arm, whether that shirt belonged to Kevin Cooper or it belonged to someone else, now can be determined with incredible precision that was not available before. And I should emphasize what these Brady violations are, and they've been well documented.
If I may add this, every time I turn around, we are discovering new evidence that not only proves my innocence, but proves that I was truly framed by the San Bernardino County. And this new evidence is not only compelling, all a person has to do is have common sense when they find out and read this stuff that we are telling the truth. Now, in the history in America, you have often had people, including judges, turn a blind eye to truth in order to have the person that they want murdered actually murdered. But whenever you have a judge forward and stands up and says, no, this person is innocent and this person was framed, you need to take that serious as a society, because judges don't often do that. That is not the rule. The rule is most judges turn a blind eye to truth on innocence because they are more concerned about procedure. In America, there's such thing in the Constitution about not executing an innocent person. If a person is innocent, but they had a quote-unquote fair trial, which seems like an oxymoron to me, then it's all right to execute them because it's about constitutional violations and all that when you get to federal court. This system is rigged. It's rigged against people like me. So if people out there don't give a damn, then this thing will never come to an end. And people end up being tortured, murdered physically by these people in here. But if society gives a damn, and they can shut these killing machines down all across this country, it's time to bring this madness to an end. Everybody thinks it's not fair. It can't be fair when the only people that get executed are poor people. It can't be fair when a person is more likely to get the death penalty if they're convicted, rightly or wrongly, of murdering white people than murdering any other skin color of a person. It's not fair. I mean, none of this is fair. It's not fair when the states can spend billions and millions and millions of dollars to get someone executed, but the defense is not giving that much to try to save a person's life to prove them innocent. Public defenders don't get as much money to defend their client as district attorneys get to prosecute those people. This is not fair. This cannot be fair that the only people who can sit on who are willing to impose the death penalty. Those are the only people who can sit on a jury. It's not fair when a black man is the only black person in the courtroom when you got a white judge, a white district attorney, a white public defender, and an all-white jury. Justice? Well, that man, that's justice? That's not fair, but that's America. I would like to see a white person sit in front of a black judge with a black prosecutor and an all-black jury and a black public defender, and I would want if they was going to get real justice, or a Native American judge, or a Native American prosecutor, public defender, and a Native American jury, and ask themselves, how do they feel? Do they feel like they're going to get real justice?
So let me just interrupt for a second, because people listening to this might say, okay, yeah, race is a factor, race is out there, but is that a cop-out here, or is it a cover-up? And I have to point out, this is not something Kevin Cooper is inventing for this case. The race has been built into it from day one. A terrible murder happened in San Bernardino County. A family got slaughtered, okay? And the survivor, the young son of this family, and he told the police, he told grandmas that three white guys did it. That's quote. They didn't say a black guy with dreadlocks or something. Now, there are suspects in this case. All that stuff about the bloody overalls and the bar and everything. There were three white guys in a bar with blood on them. That's part of the evidence that was withheld from the defense. So I don't want people to squiggle off the hook here and say, yeah, yeah, black guy bringing up the white, you know, race issue. The fact is, anyone looks at this case will see that it was informed by a racism from the first hour. The police, the sheriffs, had a horrendous murder on their hands in a rural, primarily white county of California, San Bernardino. And the first report from the surviving witness was, go find three white guys who did it. And instead, they find a black guy who'd walked off a prison farm. And he's going to be the guy. They're going to nail him. And they're going to quiet the crowd. They're going to save their political future. They're going to calm people. We got the killer. The DA of San Bernardino County, for the longest time, opposed any kind of testing of the DNA, any kind of look at the evidence. He was defeated by voters down there, in part because a very good law school professor wrote an article about his prejudicing this case. But the fact of the matter is, they had an institutional connection now with protecting their department. And it should be pointed out that sheriff's department had a lot of corruption in it. People who stole guns from the department thing and sold them out there. People who destroyed evidence. So we should talk about that. We're not talking about a bunch of saints in law enforcement.
Both call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
...of this case, he was fired after my conviction for stealing around 5 pounds of heroin from the evidence room for his own personal use and the sale of drug dealers. So while he was working, he was a heroin addict. This is the same man who claimed to have found a bloody tennis shoe imprint on a bed sheet of the victims, not at the crime scene, but by folding two pieces of sheet together. And he had an exact same pair of shoes, tennis shoes, in his office that matched the print of blood on that sheet. Clean this stuff up.
No, this is some of the stuff that Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times has led him to feel that there's been a miscarriage of justice here. And when you look at the people who, here's the judge said, a very important federal judge said, you were framed. Now, you're right, he wouldn't use that word without a great deal of consideration. That's a very serious charge for him to make. And the system will rally around not making it, not exposing it, because it, then, hey, what are we saying? We're saying that, what, the police can be corrupt? You got a case there in San Bernardino County, right, where the guy in the evidence room, he had guns that he sold. It wasn't just the drugs, right?
Sheriff himself. That was the sheriff who stole all those guns. Over 500 guns. The sheriff, the then-sheriff, Floyd Tidwell, stole and gave away to other deputy sheriffs those guns that he stole.
And he got a slap on the wrist, right? He got
a slap on the wrist.
He got what? Exactly. A misdemeanor, but then they waived it. I mean, he didn't even do time.
He didn't. This good old boys club down there in San Bernardino County. And again, I say this to your listeners. We, you and I, are not making any of this up. This is the truth about my case.
Kevin, I'm only here because I spent the last 2 years while my wife was writing what I assume will be a book about all this. I was looking at all this evidence. At first I thought, what is this all about and why are you spending all this time? And then I kept thinking, you know, wait a minute. This is so blatant, so obvious. Why hasn't anybody put a stop to it? That's the part I don't get, because we're not talking about Louisiana in the bad old days. We're talking about California, the deep blue state, you know?
If I may, I'd like to give out my website address so that people who really want to know more about this case can go and they can read Judge Fletcher's powerful and unprecedented page dissent on my case, in which those other 10 justices descended with him, and many other powerful things that vote and prove everything that you just said during this interview. And that website is
60 seconds remaining.
www.freekevincooper.org. And the media website where you can go find out who is all supporting me is www.org.
Can they get the Nick Kristof there too on your site?
Yes, you can get everything on my website. Nick Kristof's piece about my case, even the link to my podcast that I did with Mr. Kristof. You can find that on my website at freekevincooper.org.
Okay, because I think people, if they just listen to some of that, they're going to be pretty unhappy with their own apathy. And let me just add, by the way, that we've been publishing Kevin Cooper on truthdig.com, and we have a pretty good site there with a lot of material on this case. So go to truthdig.com, look up Kevin Cooper. And I want to ask you, I mean, I've always wondered about how people keep sane under these situations. I remember when Nelson Mandela got out in South Africa, I wondered, how did this guy survive being so clear and logical? And you know, I met you for 5 hours in San Quentin, and just today I was with the young lady Daniela, who a part of our leadership communications leadership program here at the Annenberg School at USC. We both talked today, and we talked about how, I don't know what the right word is, but there's a humanity that you've preserved. There's a humor, amazingly, a perspective. You know, I'm sure there's plenty of times you want to bang your head against the wall. We should talk a little bit about that. I mean, we didn't get to talk. You mentioned the books, for instance, that you've read. What's with these books? You wrote a whole piece for Truth Dig, but let's go. Which books have really influenced you, and how has that helped you there in that cage?
Real quick, because I'm running out of time. That is this. Something happened, not just to Nelson Mandela, and not just to Malcolm X, and not just to me, and not just to a lot of other people in prison. They found out that they're fighting for something that is bigger than them. And when you find out through reading books, all different types of books.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Types of books about the history of this country and the different struggles that have happened to different people, all poor, in this country. Even poor white people have been struggling in this country. And they still are struggling in this country. But yourself in a fight that is bigger than you, but yet it affects the lives of many people, and you can do something to help in that fight. You can't give up. You can't stop. You can't quit. As I was saying to you earlier, I did not choose this to speak out against the death penalty. I didn't. This stuff chose me. I did not choose it. I was up here when I was in my early 20s, and the last thing I was about doing was this type of stuff. I was practicing escapism back there. I was going outside every day, playing basketball, working out, lifting weights, doing whatever I could not to pay attention to this stuff, because this is a depressing joint that I'm in. And it's a lot of negativity, a lot of gangs, and a lot of negativity that you wouldn't believe that runs amok up in this joint. So I was practicing escapism, but one day, some older brother, his name was Brother Marshall, he gave me a book, The Autobiography of Malcolm X. So, well, that's what he told me. And I read it. And then after I read that, I wanted to read more. I didn't even know I could read. I was told when I was growing up that I wasn't going to be nothing. I couldn't read because I never tried to read. But little by little, this movement, it got ingrained. I didn't get ingrained in it because I didn't even know it existed before I came here. And this is how, when you find yourself dialing out like this, you find the strength from your ancestors, from your spirituality, from your whatever it is, to keep going. And in the process of keep going, you find more like-minded people, whether on the outside where you are or on the inside of here, who will help you to continue on. I mean, if I hadn't been in this movement, Mr. Robert Shear, I would not have met you. If I had not have been in this movement, I would have not met your wife. If I had not been in this movement, I would have never met the people from the grassroots movement called the Campaign and the Death Penalty, who helped get the Northern California Innocence Project, who in turn got the law firm of Orr, Harrington, and Sutcliffe involved in this case, which got me that stand of execution in 2004. But I'm alive today because of this movement. This movement for our human rights. This movement against the death penalty. So I can't give up. I know no way but forward. And I will continue to go forward, just as Nelson Mandela did. Because Madiba, I love that man. He was true for all people, but especially for people. I've been blessed in the sixth sense of the word. I've been cursed by putting it here. But while I'm in here, I've been blessed because there are a lot of death row inmates who commit suicide every time. They took a guy past his cage last night on a gurney because he went man down. Don't know why, but he had an oxygen mask on when they carried him by. Don't know if he lived or died, but they've been committing suicide up here. They've been killing each other up here. All types of craziness has been going on.
Let me ask you a question, though. Let's say when the... Because you're talking to me from your cage now, right?
Right.
What is it? You know, it's almost no room to walk, and you got the upside-down paint can to sit on, and you got the TV you've talked about is on some wire going
this
to some...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Abnormal living. I don't know what's normal no more.
Now. Okay, but I mean, you're in this cage, and you get off the phone, and you get depressed, let's say. What could you do in terms of a book or something or painting? Or how do you get through the next hour, the hour after that? What do you do?
So books or reading material is always at my disposal, and I've been lucky to do that. I listen to the radio. I listen to KPFA, Pacifica Radio. I always like what I stated in my column that reading is to the mind what exercise is to the body is something that I believe in. I must exercise my mind by reading different types of want to read the same thing. I want to read different things, but it's all about...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
Everything I read is about this fight that we're in, that I'm in, that poor people are in, that gays, lesbian, transgender people are in, bisexual people are in the same fight, no matter what our sexual orientation or our religion or whatever. If we're poor or we're considered different, we're deemed different by the powers that mean, and we're all in this struggle because they're trying to kill us one way or the other.
I heard a voice saying we're only at 60. We're now at 30 seconds. Is that the final cut here, or are we going to...
I got to call back one more time.
Well, we'll use the interruption from the system as an occasion for a break and be back with Kevin Cooper. We're back with Kevin Cooper after that break, and let's continue this discussion. You back on, Kevin?
I'm back on.
You know, it's interesting. People should know, I was in San Quentin with you for 5 hours in a cage where they have people interview you and so forth. And there's a certain banality of evil. I mean, a guard will take our picture, or, you know, we can buy something from the canteen or something, and, you know, and you're handcuffed when you come in, and then you have to stick your hands back out. And they, and you say with the phone, what is it? You push the buttons, or where is the phone? Do you actually get to hold it, or?
The phone itself is outside this cage on a cart. The body of the phone the receiver goes, the dial tone and the buttons and all that stuff is outside this cage on the cart. Now, I have the receiver this cage because it has a cord that may be about four feet.
I see. So you can't actually make the call.
Every time I hang up, I got to put my hand outside, do the trace light, hang up, and then redial the button.
I got involved in your case really emotionally when I went to an exhibit at Columbia University with art from people in prison. And you had one piece that I thought was really powerful right at the front of this exhibit. And the artist said, well, that's the guy that I'm interested in his case and so forth. And now I got a painting you did of John Coltrane, which I think is very powerful. And I know your art is important to you. And I know I've been talking about maybe having an exhibit of your art here at USC where we're doing this recording and elsewhere. Tell me about the art and what it means and how you do it.
My art is a therapy. It helps me not just escape from this cage that I'm locked in by going inside that painting that I'm working on at that time, but it allows me to show my appreciation to the people who I do or the scenes that I paint, because I'm being deprived of so much that I find myself doing nature scenes just because nature is beautiful and everything in here seems to be ugly. So I use bright colors and different things. I knew how to draw when I first came here and paint a little bit, but mostly I learned from PBS stations that had art shows on there, like Bob Ross and different other artists who throughout the years have been shown on PBS shows. And I would pick up something here, something there. And so I found my own style because I didn't want to copy anybody. I wanted to be me. So it's just how I learned to express myself in a situation where expressing yourself is not... It helps me scream without making a noise. You know, it helps me say something without opening my mouth. So my artwork is the way I communicate with the outside world, I guess. And I like it like that. I like to produce. I guess I'm not just a consumer, I'm also a producer. So that makes me feel good, too.
And it's a way you can earn money, so you pay for your own meals.
Art buys and all that stuff, yeah.
But let me ask you, because that scream without making a noise, that's the picture that led the Columbia exhibit.
It's called Free Me. I was doing that to my attorney, Norman. That was his painting idea for him because I'm screaming to him to free me, to get me out of here. I've never been in here. I mean, I'm screaming for the free me, man. But that's the only way I could do it where he could hear me, but not hear me. If he hung it on the wall, what it says, because it's called Free Me, every time he looks at it, he hears me without hearing me.
Tell me about your attorney, because he would have been retired by now. He's put in a lot of time on this case, and He's the go-to guy in your defense, Norm Heil, right?
Yeah, and I've been very blessed as my attorney at Oort. In 2004, it was David Alexander, who was the attorney from Oort, that helped get me that stay of execution. But when David left Oort, Norman stepped in and took his place.
That's a kind of respectable law firm, right, in San Francisco.
Right, Oort, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. They're not a criminal law firm. And that's something else about this criminal justice system. This white-collar law firm comes and takes my case away from an attorney, a criminal defense attorney, who damn near got me executed. And they use the same information that he had, and they get me a stay of execution. So that says something about this rotten ass system when they appoint attorneys to you who will get you murdered because they don't care. And you mucked up and got this law firm who did care, and they end up getting me a stay. And Norman is part of that law firm, and he could have been retired like 10 years ago, but he said he was not retiring until he either got me out or I got executed. He believes he's going to get me out. So we just have to keep fighting. And I'm truly blessed to have a man like that who cares enough to not abandon me the way I've been abandoned in this place by so many other people. Thank God for Norman. And I don't thank God for many people.
Well, you know, I'm very impressed with Norm Heil. So is my wife, Narda. And he's not one of these lawyers that you hear a lot about in terms of, you know, like the old William Kunstler, people like that.
And your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
But, you know, in a very effective, quiet way, he has really opened up this case. And also, you got an ex-FBI agent helping you on this case, a guy who was second in command in the L.A. FBI office.
Yeah, Mr. Tom Parker, he's a former special FBI agent, and came, he saw my case, he read it. He said, man, this guy is innocent, and I'm going to get him. And that's what he's been doing for the last 8 or 9 years. And he's come up, a lot of this new evidence that we come up with, he's found it. A lot of new witnesses that we come up with, he's located them. I, again, have been blessed by people who, the outside of this California criminal justice system, have come in to this criminal justice system on a helping to expose the wrongs in my case that without them would not have been exposed, been dead a long time ago.
That's why I just don't get it. I just don't get it.
Your call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I mean, how can you read that clemency petition? How can you look at what Norm Heil compiled and what Tom Parker came up with, Nick Kristof in the New York Times wrote about? You look at all this stuff, and what you're only asking, I keep repeating this, but it should not be lost here, is more precise DNA testing using modern means, re-examination of the prospect of innocence, innocence hearing, and that's what they're resisting. I think that your case is a case study in the cynicism of this whole thing, you know, because what is the cost? Your defense is willing to pay for the testing. What is the cost? You know, why the rush to judgment? Why the rush to judgment in the face of new evidence? New evidence.
There is a cost to be paid when we prove my innocence more so than we already have, because this criminal justice system will suffer for it.
Not if we're an enlightened society, it'll benefit, you know.
What does that mean?
Well, I'm just saying, who with a straight face would want to say, let's rush to judgment and kill someone for whom there's evidence showing innocence? That's what the Brady, people look up, who are listening to this, look up what a Brady violation is. That's what they're saying. They're saying six different times the authorities in this case down in San Bernardino County suppressed evidence, distorted evidence that would show a man who's on death row to be innocent. And then the other people, like in the governor's office, can ignore that, walk away from it. That's not right.
Okay. You don't care, man.
Well, the whole purpose of doing journalism is to get them to care, you know, is to make them care. That's why we're doing this interview, and I'm going to do my best to have them listen to it, others listen to it.
And I think in a little bit of time I got left, I would like to say this. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. And I thank you for exposing the truth about my case. But this case is no different than a whole lot of other cases that people have the history of this death penalty. I mean, look what happened to Troy Davis in Georgia not too long ago. You know, I mean, there's cases like this all the time that come up. But the system is so hell-bent on killing us, they don't give a damn about innocence. It's about the system. It's about the process. It's about their justice.
30 seconds remaining.
Thank you very much. All right, peace out. Bye-bye.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. The prison authorities have told our time is over, and that's it for part two of my interview with Kevin Cooper. We did part one last week. Both of them will be posted on KCRW and elsewhere. And let me just say something. I was in there for 5 hours. We could have done this interview in person, but we did it by phone. There are interruptions, but this is a minor part of what prison life is all about. And I think there's a compelling case. We've tried to make part of it here that everyone in prison deserves innocence hearings, deserves an examination of their case. But here on death row, because the voters of California have decided, in effect, to re-implement the death penalty to hasten the process, there's real urgency behind requesting an innocence hearing for Kevin Cooper, re-examination, retesting the DNA that was tampered with, and chemicals were used that show it was not the original test and so forth. And I want to say to Kevin, I hope this goes well. And I do believe in your case, and I certainly believe in that people should listen to it. Our engineers are Kat Yore and Mario Diaz. Producers are Isabel Carrion and Josh Shear, and we'll see you next week. I do want to say I will do a part three if it's needed, but hopefully justice will be served and Kevin can come out and do an interview in a studio at KCRW sometime in the near future. So take care, Kevin.